Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
This new year brings a new reality for many Central Floridians. The cost of health care outweighs their ability to pay. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, January 8th, 2026. Coming up, tensions rise ahead of a decisive vote on the site of Eatonville's first school for Black students. And we learn why New Year's food resolutions can crumble so quickly, especially around fast food. First, Florida has the highest number of people in the country receiving health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Last year, 4.7 million Floridians signed up for coverage, which is more than any other state. This year, extra ACA discounts ended because Congress let enhanced tax credits expire at the end of 2025. Those federal subsidies were added during the COVID pandemic to expand eligibility and to lower monthly premiums. Now that they're no longer in effect because Congress didn't extend them, people having to pay the full premium themselves are encountering dramatic increases in prices, even if they didn't change plans. People like Eric Rawlings, a self-employed real estate agent in Orlando, diagnosed with a congenital heart condition that requires treatment and medication. He says his Affordable Care Act insurance plan premium more than doubled this year to over $1,300 a month. And Lynette Bidwell from Winter Garden worked in retail management before disability forced her to stop working. She needs regular medical care. But sticker shock from a steep increase in her ACA insurance premium led her to change plans, pushing her out of her longtime physician's network. Engaged producer Richard Copeland sits down with Lynette Bidwell and Eric Rawlings to talk about the choices they're being forced to make shaping their health and futures.
Lynette, you've seen your health plan increase by 589%. Is this off of the ACA marketplace or private?
It's off the marketplace. So based off of last year, the same plan went up 589%.
Take me back to that moment where you saw your health insurance jump by almost 600%. What went through your mind?
Well, I gasped with my navigator who assisted with me signing up. And we both, at the same time, I was like her first client with open enrollment. And she's like, we're going to do this together. And we opened it up and we both were like, oh, my word. And it took 5 hours, different sessions with calculators, trying to figure out another insurance plan.
And in dollars, what was the premium before and what is it looking like now?
The premium was $37. It jumped up to $218.
And what does this mean for your routine monthly budgeting?
I have to pull a little bit tighter, look at my budget, see where I can kind of cut a few corners.
Preliminarily, do you know where that'll be?
It'll be with the groceries, utilities, you know, not having Netflix, cable.
And you said you looked at other options with your navigator. This was the best one?
It was not the best one. It was the one that we originally wanted to go with, which is what I had in 2025. But with the jump of the increase and also they dropped vision. So I'm going without vision for 2026. And I also lost my primary doctor.
What does that mean for you?
I've been with him for 10 years. And so he has all my medical history. So it's really important. He's like the gatekeeper. And if I want to see him, I have to pay out of pocket.
Will you?
If I have to see him, I will. I had to make a choice between two other providers that I needed to continue through 26. So they were in the plan. So I kept them and had to make a choice to drop my primary.
Now, Eric, you're seeing your premium more than double.
113%.
And you're with Florida Blue Health?
Yes.
Talk about your efforts to find an affordable plan that meets your requirements?
Okay, well, it's that's next to impossible right now, unless they're going to go back in and redo this in Washington, D.C. We're just screwed on a lot of these plans. I mean, it's the exact same coverage that I had last year, exact same plan, no improvements, nothing taken away. And I was paying $582 last year. Now I'm going to be paying $1,362.
And you're in real estate, you're self-employed?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you've arranged your own.
Oh, we have to. There's not really a group plan because we're all really independent contractors within a real estate company or brokerage. So we're responsible. We're all basically self-employed. And so there isn't like a group plan. I mean, there are different plans that are like through an association or something like that, but the coverage usually isn't that good. I just had a heart stent put in and the medication is horribly expensive that I have to be on. So a lot of people, a lot of real estate agents that I know, they'll use the emergency room for their health care. And so they're going to go uninsured. Unfortunately, right now, that's not an option for me because some of the pills that I'm taking are $900 for a 90-day supply. So when you add three or four of those pills up, you have to have insurance. There's no other option.
So can you quantify how far out of pocket you'll be going?
Well, it'll be $1,362 for the coverage. And then my copay is $9,150 a year out of pocket. That's the maximum. I don't have a deductible, and that's the same plan that I had. So I have the copays went up insignificantly. I think it went from 75 to 100 or something like that. But when you total all that up between the medications that have a copay and that you have the office visits plus the premium, it's going to impact how I live my life so I can live my life, especially when you're talking about going out to eat or doing things with my friends, you know, am I going to go on a week vacation? No, it looks like it's going to be a staycation for a weekend because it's either paying for my insurance or going on vacation.
Lynette, when Eric mentioned his contemporaries going to the ER, mm-hmm. you started shaking your head emphatically.
Yeah, because people are going to have, they're going to use that as their insurance is going to, instead of being able to do preventative care, we're going to end up doing crisis care. And that's going to affect our generation currently now. And then what's going to look like in 10 years from now? You know, when you didn't have the preventative care that you should have had for 10 years.
So let me take that back to you, Eric. You said you recently had a heart stent put in. That requires extensive follow-up care.
Right. Well, and every time that I go in for a scan to see how my heart's doing, that's $500 out of pocket. $488.88 to be exact. But to follow up what Lynette was saying, I did this because I got a free heart scan that you see on Facebook. And I just went in there and they said, yeah, it looks like you might have an issue. This is something I've been walking around with for 15 or 20 years. It's something congenital. But had I not caught it and had I waited until something really bad happened, like a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, the going to the emergency room and not having that preventative care would have cost the entire system and myself 100 times more.
Now, Lynette talked about some of the places where she may find herself cutting corners due to this shift in the budgeting. Are you finding the same?
When I've been asked, even recently, that where I've had to say no, these are small businesses that I frequent in Orlando. So it's this ripple effect. And I'm selling real estate. I've also had people say, hey, you know, right after the year, first of the year, we're going to start looking for a house. Now that I just got a call and this family, their insurance went up $1,100 a month. Mm-hmm. That was going to be what they were going to help put down and for closing costs on that. And they're like, we just don't know. Mm-hmm. And we've got two kids in school and we're not sure if something happens, are we going to get ourselves into a new house and not going to be able to pay for the healthcare or vice versa. And so now you're talking about a gigantic ripple effect, even a tsunami effect.
And Lynette, I want to ask you your age. You are retired.
I am retired.
healthcare in your demographic is a major issue. Talk about how this is affecting your well-being.
I've had three major surgeries over about 20 years. After having three major surgeries, you end up having other issues other than chronic pain, major depression, and you're having to manage that. Also, it's adding stress of having to manage my health care and making sure I have coverage because one surgery is $160,000 out of pocket. I can lose my home. So it's, you know, my home. I need my home.
How do you talk about this with your family?
Well, I only have my mom to talk with. So, you know, she's talking about her Medicaid and how much that's even going to change. There's no demographic. There is no social class that's not going to feel the ripple effect of this. And it's really going to affect everybody's life moving forward, 26, 27, 28, you know, not having the stability every day, just knowing we have insurance and it's like good insurance. Because I remember 2025 when I signed up, I was like, oh, thank you. I was so relieved. I was so happy. I was excited. And now I'm like almost shaking every day. And they're almost pricing us out of our health.
Lynette Bidwell and Eric Rawlings are just two examples of what's happening. Scott Darius is Executive Director of Florida Voices for Health, a nonprofit advocacy organization working to improve healthcare outcomes for Floridians. Engage producer Richard Copeland talks to Darius about the ripple effects he's seeing beyond monthly premium hikes and what the year could look like if Congress doesn't extend ACA tax credits and nothing changes.
I think people are just faced with really difficult choices, especially those who are remaining in the marketplace, who know that they need the coverage, who need particular doctors covered or prescriptions covered. They're all facing these incredible increases in prices because there are two things happening at once. Insurers have increased their baseline rate for insurance, but at the same time, there's this reduced help and support that comes in the form of the enhanced premium tax credits. I always encourage people to still look at what the options are because there is still some level of support. There are still some tax credits available, but it won't be enough. It hasn't been enough to absorb the huge increase that we're seeing this year.
So why are these increases so dramatic? Usually if we see increases, they're incremental.
You know, part of what the insurers themselves have pointed to in their justifications that they submit to our Florida Office of Insurance Regulation, but they pointed to a lot of what we've seen on the federal level over the last few months. The anticipated impacts of some of the changes we've seen at the federal level has led insurers to believe that there will be less people, especially less healthy people, enrolled in health insurance. And that's in large part what's driven these massive increases in care. A lot of the insurers also in anticipation that Congress wouldn't extend these tax credits, then subsequently raise their rates because the folks who are most likely to forego coverage are those who are healthier, meaning insurers want to cover themselves to make sure that, right, like if they have a high amount of users left in the plans, that they have the money to cover that. And so one thing kind of feeds the other, and it's consumers, it's voters, the rest of us who pay for it.
Insofar as what we're seeing in Central Florida, are there specific communities that are seeing an exorbitant rate hike, maybe not in line with other communities? Are you seeing patterns developing?
You know, I think the bottom line for who's impacted are workers, right? And that's workers across the board, whether you're from one background or another, especially those who are working in kind of those industries that are the backbone of our economy and, you know, maybe making around 300 or 400% of the poverty level. So middle class workers, I think, are the ones who suffer the most because the enhanced premium tax credits, I think, really supported folks working closer to that end of the income scale. And especially if you're over that 40% by just a little bit. Now, you know, as you consider who typically works in some of these industries and the makeup of Central Florida, I think the impact on immigrant communities is one worth talking about. The industries that recent immigrants especially tend to work in are some of those industries that, like I talked about, are the backbone of Florida's economy. So in retail, in customer service, hospitality, it's those folks who aren't offered health insurance through their normal work who will be facing these increases in care. And, you know, sometimes it's not just the increase in what you're paying for the premium. Maybe you ultimately end up paying less, but what you sacrifice is coverage. And maybe for folks who have ongoing health needs, having to sacrifice one or two things that you've really relied on to maintain your health. And so this thing plays out any number of ways, but I do think it's workers and immigrant communities who are especially bearing the brunt of this.
And to clarify, what immigrant status qualifies for ACA coverage?
Before the One Big Beautiful Bill, every lawfully present immigrant could sign up in the ACA and receive tax credits. That's been limited since the passage of H.R. 1, and now it's only lawful permanent residents or green card holders who can qualify for tax credits in the marketplace. And that leaves out refugees and asylees and people with temporary protected status, a lot of folks who relied on the coverage in years previous, who at least when this is fully implemented, beginning January 2027, will be left out of the marketplace. It's important to note that those folks actually this year still have the opportunity to get covered. If you're lawfully present, you still have the opportunity to get in the marketplace and receive tax credits this year. But beginning January 2027, those folks are left out.
We'll talk about the larger impact on the community when people have to be forced to choose what aspects of their health care they will attend to and which they will essentially ignore.
Yeah, it's all bad choices left for people, right? First, there's a fundamental choice between maintaining healthcare coverage and paying for other essentials, whether that's housing or food or just all the other things we need to sustain ourselves. But then once you get to just the healthcare decision making, we've been encouraging people to make a list of their priorities, right? In terms of their providers, if there's someone that they're, you know, already have a relationship with, prescription drugs, if that's an important thing to them, or just making sure that a certain service is covered. What we found is that a lot of folks who previously were able to afford silver and gold level plans, meaning there's less cost sharing and more achievable deductibles, a lot of those folks are being forced into bronze level plans, right? Because that's what they can afford month to month with the little bit of help that's still available. But yeah, what you get there are really high deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. You have very limited networks that might not include a provider that you've had for a very long time. And yeah, those are the conversations we're having with people and seeing what they have to navigate.
And of course, when you talk about people being forced to make those decisions, preventative care is usually the first to be jettisoned.
Preventative care especially is a crucial one for us here in Florida, where if you look at oral health, dental health, what we pay in the emergency room for completely preventable dental issues, last year it was almost $1 billion. It was over $900 million that we paid in emergency rooms for completely preventable dental issues. And that's just dental. So what we as a society pay out, what private plans pay out, what Medicaid pays out for these things that can be prevented, I think is just a major flaw in the way our healthcare system is designed. But if we continue to take away access to preventative care for people, we're only going to see those things, those numbers show up somewhere else. That shows up in what we pay out of the emergency room and really the strain on the safety net.
I want to bring in something people may be hearing from lawmakers. Some people argue letting these subsidies expire is a good thing because the enhanced tax credits were temporary and the market should correct itself. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I'll say the world was in a certain place when these enhanced premium tax credits passed. We all saw the need that people had as people were losing jobs and just needed the help paying for healthcare. Now, where the world is now, although, you know, we're in a much better place when it comes to level of employment, I think the cost of living is the thing that's changed. Where housing costs are astronomical, where food costs are astronomical, and especially here in Florida, people are really feeling the squeeze of the cost of living. And so, yeah, the situation has changed, but it's still just as dire, right? And as you have the cost of healthcare itself increase, and we've done nothing to actually address that part, these tax credits, some I would argue, are more important now than they were before. But I think it'll point to the fact that it's still a crucial need for people. And so if that was justification enough back then, the same is certainly still true.
Looking forward, is there an avenue for recourse? can this bell be unrung?
You know, I'll say a couple of things. One, I'm encouraged by what we saw at the end of last year, where we had bipartisan support for discharge position. And I believe last week or earlier this week, Speaker Johnson has at least committed to bringing up this vote for the tax credits this week. And so we expect it to pass the House. We hope it'll pass the House. The Senate will take it up and we'll see what happens there. And if it passes, it'll go to the president. And I think there are very real challenges. Even if the tax credits are passed now, you'll have to figure out how to support those folks who have maybe already signed up for a plan, or people who foregoed the opportunity to sign up for a plan because of cost. And so you'll have to come up with a way to get around some of the technical challenges, right? Of just making sure that people have tax credits and have the full slate of options in front of them. But as difficult as that is, it's doable.
Scott Darius is executive director at Florida Voices for Health. Some groups argue that Congress should allow the temporary COVID-era tax credits to expire as intended. Americans for Prosperity's position is that the expiration will not blow up the cost of health care. Dean Clancy, senior health policy fellow at Americans for Prosperity, joins us from Sarasota to talk about why he says letting the temporary subsidies end could help long-term and promote alternative options.
The ACA subsidies that were added during the pandemic do not actually reduce health insurance premiums or lower health care costs. They simply mask those costs. They shift them to the taxpayer. Health insurance prices have been going up for years, and especially so under the Affordable Care Act. The subsidies basically pick up a share of that, about 90% of the cost for people enrolled in the Affordable Care Act plans. Now that the subsidies have expired, that system is still subsidizing 80% of the cost of an average health insurance policy. So there is no premium crisis. There's just a change in the subsidy levels. We've gone back to the Obamacare of 2020.
So you offer multiple steps to a healthcare system you feel would be more effective and efficient than that Affordable Care Act, including implementing tax-free health savings accounts, expanding employer-provided flex accounts. Are these viable paths for the person living paycheck to paycheck working in Florida that do rely on the ACA?
Yes, these reforms that we're talking about absolutely will help bring down the cost of care and give people access to more and better options. Health savings accounts, for example, enable you to obtain care and access to doctors that your insurance doesn't necessarily cover. One of the problems with the Affordable Care Act has been shrinking provider networks, people unable to find a doctor that's convenient to them or that will see them in a timely way. Wait times are at record highs. And having an HSA, a tax-free account that you can use for medical expenses, enables you to go to the doctor you want or buy the care you want. And you can do it from the convenience of a smartphone. It's really like a personal medical wallet. That's just one idea. Another is workplace flex plans or choice arrangements. These enable you to get tax-free money from your employer to buy personal and portable insurance that you own rather than it being a workplace plan. What that means is you don't lose your insurance when you change jobs. And you can look for a plan that's much more affordable than what your employer is offering. And there are many more ideas. Association health plans, letting small businesses band together so they can get group discounts at rates similar to what large employers can get. And of course, we need to reform federal mandates like the Affordable Care Act so that the price of insurance falls for people. When we have millions of people actually spending their own money for healthcare with help from the government, of course, and with insurance, you're going to find that providers are going to compete for their business and reveal their prices, and that's going to drive prices down through competition and innovation.
Let me ask you about where we are right now. We talk to people losing their doctors, delaying care, or even going without insurance. How do you respond to Central Floridians facing these huge premium hikes now that the tax credits have expired?
Well, the expiration of the tax credits has increased the out-of-pocket cost for many people enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. That's true. These are very affordable plans, even if, thanks to the expiration, folks now have to pay a little bit, have some skin in the game, contribute toward the cost. The real pain point here is the more affluent folks who make more than, say, $130,000 a year for a family of four. They lose their subsidy altogether. They've lost it now that the subsidies have expired. And some of them do have high medical expenses, but remember, they didn't have any subsidy at all 5 years ago, and most people would consider them to be affluent enough to pay for their own health care. But if they have really high expenses, and maybe they're in their early 60s, too young for Medicare, it could be painful for them. For them, I do think Congress should have targeted relief, and they should do the kinds of things we've talked about, like health savings accounts, association health plans, and workplace choice arrangements, so that they can find more affordable options and stay covered.
Is access to health insurance a responsibility shared as a society, or is it primarily an individual one?
Well, the way I would put it is healthcare is not a right. Healthcare freedom is a right. The freedom to obtain the healthcare you need without having to ask anyone's permission, a government bureaucrat or an insurance company bureaucrat for that matter. Nobody should stand between you and the doctors you trust. Obviously, you have to pay for it. And some people are short of funds. And for them, society does have a responsibility, we believe, to provide safety nets. But the safety nets should be narrow and targeted to those who are truly vulnerable. And unfortunately, in our time, big programs like Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act have become incredibly wasteful and fraud-riddled. And so, for example, in Florida, there are, I suppose, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people enrolled in these programs unlawfully. They've underreported their income, or they've maybe an unscrupulous insurance industry representative has signed them up for coverage, possibly without their knowledge, simply to access federal subsidies. It's a real mess, and we're wasting a lot of money doing it. So we need to reform those programs, but we do need to have safety nets for the truly vulnerable.
Dean Clancy is Senior Health Policy Fellow at Americans for Prosperity. There's more ahead here on Engage. A key vote is coming in a long-running dispute over a historic Eatonville property. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on this program, we all start the new year with the best of intentions, with revised resolutions, usually involving tweaks to our diet. We ask the question, why are New Year's resolutions so hard to maintain?
A lot of this has to do with the fact that everyday Americans kind of exist in a obesogenic environment, which means that's a fancy word for saying that our everyday environment is geared towards making us fat.
UCF food anthropologist Ty Matioski joins us to parse out our dietary resolutions. But first, tensions are rising in Eatonville, the nation's oldest incorporated Black town, over the future of land there that shaped its past. The Hungerford School property is more than 100 acres off of I-4. The land was donated by the Hungerford family to the town of Eatonville in the 1800s. It later became the Hungerford School and served as the town's first school for Black students for decades. After it closed in 2009, the buildings were demolished during the COVID pandemic. Now, Orange County Schools and the town of Eatonville are locked in a fight that's been going on for years over who should control the land and what happens to it. Most recently, critics of the plan to sell it to Dr. Phillips Charities for Development questioned the financial benefit and how much it would actually bring in for the town in tax revenue. Central Florida Public Media education reporter Danielle Pryor joins Engage now as the mayor, town council, and school board get ready for a key vote. Danielle, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So there is a lot of back and forth, a lot of emotion here, which we are going to get to.
Right.
Can you clarify actual proposal and the current agreement in place for the Hungerford site?
So we know that the agreement comes after that failed development deal and the failed lawsuit that we've covered over the last few years. But basically, in September, the Orange County School Board voted to begin the transfer of the Hungerford School property to Dr. Phillips Charities. And then Dr. Phillips Charities will pay the district over $1 million for the former school site. Per the agreement, they're going to work with the town of Eatonville, whoever is the new mayor, the town council, and they're going to figure out how to develop the land. Right now, it looks like an early learning center, museum, new town hall, a community hub, even a clinic. But as you said, people are very divided and passionate on both sides of this issue. We've seen the school board be very supportive of the proposed land sale, but then the town council has come out against it vehemently.
Help me understand. There is a deal.
Mm-hmm.
What is still undecided if this was approved months ago?
Right. So that was a memorandum of understanding. And then there's going to be the January 13th vote to kind of move forward the contract between the Orange County School District and the Dr. Phillips Charities to sell the land. But basically, the town council really feels like they weren't included in any of the conversations and any of the preliminary planning to sell the property. They say that it was done behind closed doors with the mayor of the town, Angie Gardner. So they just wanted to have like 90 days more to think over this proposed land sale. Here is Eatonville Town Council member Ledwina Jordan explaining how the council feels.
Sometimes it's not what you do, it's how you do it. And that is my point. The way that this has come to be, it has not been fair to the council. Our mayor, she went and spoke for us, right? We are a 5-member board.
And so, again, they wanted an extension. They say they want time to make suggestions and changes, maybe come up with their own plan for how to use the Hungerford School property. They say they just got the contract over the holiday and just really didn't have time to read it over. And here's Jordan again kind of explaining their proposal.
What I'm asking is that you all please allow us the time, 90 days minimum. We're going to be going into a new election period. We will have a new mayor. Things are changing hands in our community right now.
So I think that brings us to the meeting this week and what you heard there. What stood out to you about how the different sides are talking about this deal?
Right. So first of all, they were not given the 90-day extension. So they're moving ahead with that January 13th vote, most likely to sell the land. We had the Orange County School Board, I think, expressing frustration. They really liked the land sale, and they've been working on it for so many years. And so there were folks like Orange County School Board member Alicia Ferrant, who called the deal like, this is golden. This is gold. Why are there issues? Why is there wait or delay?
Dr. Phillips Charities came in. They have an incredible plan that has been in partnership with the community at community meetings. Your community was here back in June or September, one of those meetings, and or at both. We've heard from adults, children, grandparents, all ages, who are excited about the hope and the future that Dr. Phillips Charities, this partnership could be for the town of Eatonville. And sadly, it is being sabotaged or attempted to be sabotaged by your own council members.
And then we had town council members, pretty much all of them, including Wanda Randolph, who said that the deal was highway robbery and that it could lead to the end of the town of Eatonville as we know it.
We don't want to fall as a victim into that circumstances that we're not able to pay our bills. We're not able to carry on the services and the operations that are needed in Eatonville in order for us to survive as a town. We do not want to be the one lost town in the nation like some of the other black towns have completely failed because they did not have enough funds and revenue to keep the town going because of lack of development. The residents of Eatonville are very emotional about the property because it is the largest parcel that we have in the town of Eatonville. After this, if it doesn't work, there's no more property for us to go at the rate of development that we are going after today.
And what are you hearing from the mayor herself?
She is for this, but she kind of helped to orchestrate the deal, as we know. So Mayor Angie Gardner is really celebrating and says that this is going to bring about a better future for current and future generations of young people living in Eatonville. She's very positive and optimistic about this proposed sale.
If we truly want what's best for our town, if we truly want to move forward, if we want retail, if we want jobs, if we want an early learning center, if we want those things that we have stated that we have wanted, this is a pretty great opportunity that we should not pass by this moment.
And Danielle, how are people in the community weighing the site's legacy with the development and economic growth moving forward?
So people are really split, and I've seen this across several different Orange County School Board meetings over the last couple of months. So you have people like John Beecham, who I've interviewed for lots of stories over the last few years, who says that the land should be the town of Eatonville's. And he says Eatonville and the Hungerford School are history and tradition and it's home, and it's wrong to sell off this land.
And I stand against the sale of this hallowed grounds of the Hungerford School property. This land is sacred. It's a burial place for our ancestors, once refuge of the former enslaved people. And the foundation of Eatonville, the first self-governing black town in America, it must be protected, just as we honor the indigenous people whose lands were taken before. If you knew the story of Eatonville, you would see Eatonville as a place to preserve history. Eatonville is a living museum.
But then you have younger generations of Eatonville residents like Michelle Ford, who is a mom of a very young son. And she's at a lot of these meetings actually with her son. And she says she sees this proposed sale as a way forward for the town. And she's excited about all the opportunities it might bring for her son and for his generation.
Everything in this plan for Dr. Phillips benefits the community. It breaks poverty. This is ridiculous what individuals are coming up here to say. What I will say is this: there's individuals in our own town that wants to make a profit off of this land. So I'm asking this board to do what's best for the children and for the residents. Don't let them get their hands on it. This is a deal of a lifetime. This is actually bringing what the town was built to 2.0.
Danielle, can we talk a little bit just about the long-term financial survival for the small town? Can you speak to why this property is so important in that way?
Yeah, so we heard Councilwoman Wanda Randolph kind of talk about this, but it's kind of the last and the largest parcel that could be developed in the town of Eatonville. And she sees it as an economic opportunity to continue to make sure that the township is financially sustainable and stable moving forward. Again, she'd like Eatonville to be in charge of this last largest parcel. But it's not just the money, it's the fact that this is a school that educated generations of people in the community. There are so many people still alive that were students there, that were teachers there, that were principals there at the school. And so it's something close to people's hearts, and it's part of the town, and it's part of the town's history. As someone said yesterday in the meeting, it's a part of not just Eatonville history, but Central Florida history, and it's a part of Black American history. And so people really want to make sure it's preserved in the right way.
Danielle, as you continue to follow these developments, what are the next key dates that you're paying attention to?
So January 13th is that Orange County School Board meeting where they're going to make the final vote on whether to allow the contract to move forward and whether to ultimately sell the land. And if you can't make the meeting, stream it on the Orange County School Board YouTube website, and that will be at the regularly scheduled school board meeting time.
Central Florida Public Media education reporter Danielle Pryor, thank you for joining us on Engage.
Thank you.
Coming up, the culture and clever tactics that feed the failure of New Year's fast food resolutions. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. The beginning of January is peak New Year's resolutions season. New year, new you, right? It's when people say, I am done with fast food, I only eat kale now, and this year, I'm sticking to it. Then the resolution starts to crumble. But why? We ask UCF professor Ty Matiaski, who specializes in cultural anthropology and food studies, what research says about the reasons fresh starts around fast food often fail.
Mid-January is kind of like the time where New Year's resolutions go to die. Although we kind of end and begin the year with the best of intentions, sometimes it's hard to resist the gravitational pull that fast food exerts on our appetites. So a lot of this has to do with the fact that everyday Americans kind of exist in a obesogenic environment, which means that's a fancy word for saying that our everyday environment is geared towards making us fat. So like food is readily available, like nutritionally deficient, calorically dense food, whether it's, you know, convenience store fare or fast food is easily obtainable. It's convenient. It has an immediate pleasure at the, you know, in the moment of consumption, but later on it can prove regrettable.
Do you find that Florida's fast food culture is different from other parts of the country? And I'm thinking Central Florida specifically. We have theme park tourists and then late night workers at the parks, snowbirds. I'm wondering if that changes the fast food scene.
Well, you know, it does have a lot in common with other kind of metro urban areas, but you do see, you know, certain influences that maybe you don't see in other parts of the country. You know, you have like Pollo Tropical, kind of the Cuban type of fast food that you don't readily encounter outside of Florida. You have kind of like standard bearers of like Checkers and these types of brands that you don't really see outside of certain parts of the country. There was a time when Whataburger was here, but no longer. So that's in more northern Florida. So there are, you know, certain brands that kind of are more closely associated, I guess, with Central Florida.
Is there a way to separate this? Are we wired as Americans to biologically love fast food, or is it mostly cultural?
I would say it's both. So we are evolutionary hardwired to seek out calorically rich foods, particularly ones that are sweet or savory. And thousands of millions of years ago in our evolutionary past, you know, these were infrequently encountered. But today, given the mass consumption, mass production of certain types of foods, typically the ones that have high amounts of fructose and they're calorically dense, we get like the reward sensation of consuming them, but it is not something that we are hardwired to eat in frequent amounts. And then the cultural part of it is there as well, in the sense that we are bombarded with all types of marketing. We have to eat at some point. So sometimes it's easy to go for the food that's convenient, the food that requires less preparation, the food that provides like immediate sensations.
I'm wondering from your perspective, why do we turn to fast food when we're stressed or sad?
So we may have these resolutions at the end of December, early part of January, or have the best of intentions. But coming out of the holiday season, which is a time of stress, you kind of get a lull before you go back to work or school. And then that time of year kind of hits you, the stress of the job, the stress of taking classes, and it kind of grinds down your willpower. And in moments of less vigilance, it's easy to go for fast food. Even though prices are up across the fast food sector, it's still relatively inexpensive. And I know a lot of brands now are kind of reverting to like their $5 menus, again, which have high amounts of calories, high amounts of saturated fats, high amounts of the greasy fare that we tend to like to consume, even though we may regret it later.
So do you consider fast food its own kind of ritual?
Well, there are certain rituals involved with fast food in the sense that, you know, like when you pull into the McDonald's drive-thru, you kind of follow this script where they ask you if you're going to be using the McDonald's app, and you tell them either yes or no, and then you kind of tell them your order. Sometimes you have to repeat your order, and then you go to the window and pay for it. So it does follow a script like a ritual. You kind of know what to expect in terms of ordering and consuming food. Fast food is rife with certain types of symbols like the Golden Arches or the Burger King crown. So these kind of resonate with us, as do kind of like the warm color schemes that a lot of fast foods utilize. So like reds, yellows, oranges, these tend to be the kind of ones that appeal to humans on some base level in terms of like getting us excited about eating certain types of hamburgers, fried chicken, french fries, these sort of fare.
Any advice on how to actually keep that resolution?
Yeah, I would say go for small wins. Try to approach it incrementally. Take it day by day. Don't couch things in all or nothing. And then try to build towards a goal. And then, you know, once you've attained that goal, kind of look towards expanding it. And then by some point, you'll have gotten enough days without fast food behind you that it becomes easier and easier to kind of commit to this new dietary regimen. Like these public health challenges, Dry January, Meatless January, these kind of align with giving up fast food or giving up meat or red meat in particular, or giving up alcohol. These are seen as efforts to kind of like kickstart a more healthy lifestyle.
Are those methods of accountability or are they traps?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could be both, right? I guess it just depends on the individual and the circumstances. Culturally speaking, there are, in the liturgical calendar, you have the period of Lent, which is preceded by Fat Tuesday or Mardi Gras, you know, where people kind of have these Bacchanalian revelry right before you like kind of put the brakes on certain consuming or engaging in certain types of dietary regimens. In Islam, you have Ramadan, a period of fasting that goes along. So there are like antecedents or precedents, both globally and culturally, in terms of these periods of denial that are kind of related to a calendar of some sort.
I want to know, when you, Ty, go to a fast food restaurant, can you just eat it and enjoy it? Or does the anthropologist in you just start analyzing?
Yeah, I don't often go to like a sit down fast food restaurant. You know, if I do get it, sometimes it's going through the drive through or with my sons in particular. But yeah, I can enjoy it for what it is. But, you know, every now and then I find that the anthropologist in me kind of creeps out, and I can kind of like see things, how they're operating at a different type of level than like the superficial level.
That's Ty Matiosky, professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at UCF. That's all for today's edition of Engage. Next week, Florida's legislative session begins, and we're following issues that could shape life for Central Florida families. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so every episode is sent right to you. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. NPR News is next.